friends, and welcome to 2024. I know lots of my friends were pretty happy to say goodbye to 2023. It was a really challenging year for lots and lots of people that I know. So welcome to a new one. 2024, here we all come. And guess what? We're also starting season 16 of the podcast, if you can believe that. I know each season is only comprised of 10 episodes, but still, it's kind of exciting. When I started the pod so long ago, I didn't even imagine I would get to episode 150, let alone episode 151, which is where we're at this week. It feels really good to begin the new year with the new season, and I want to thank so many people, my Patreon supporters, all my friends who've texted me and told me how much they love the podcast and how delightful they find the guests who agree to be on the podcast. I honestly could not do the podcast without my Patreon supporters and without all those who have agreed to discuss some of the most seminal moments of their lives in public. And of course, you know what I'm going to say. If you like what I'm doing, please consider supporting me on Patreon. It's a truly sweet way for people to kind of sponsor a human being who's doing good work. There will be a link to my Patreon under the episode show notes. I also wanted to point out that I have a new podcast cover. It's super exciting, and I got some photos done, some headshots, for the first time in my life. This is a big deal for me, as I really made an art form out of hiding and not showing myself to the world. So this was a big step out for me. I hope you appreciate the new podcast cover. And, you know, after the headshots were done, I went on Yelp, I went on Google, and I gave the photographer a 5-star review and wrote about what I loved about the experience. She was so over the moon that I took the time, and I thought, you know what? I beg every week for new ratings and new reviews from my listeners, from pretty much everyone I run into. And so I know that the hustle is real and they're so important. So please, dear listeners, if you can find it in your hearts to give me a rating or write a little review, I would be so very grateful. So now we're going to get to my guest, Emerald Carter, this week, who is a pretty spectacular human being. Emerald's done a lot of super delightful and cool stuff, and I quote-unquote picked her up at an event in Santa Fe before I moved up to Chicago. She's an artist from Brooklyn, New York. The reason we kind of connected was she went to seminary as well. She graduated from Union Theological Seminary. She also went to Tufts. She's a poet. She's a writer. She's an artist. She's a creator. She's a teacher. She's so many things. And I am so very grateful that Spirit brought her into this world so that I could meet her and have this delightful conversation. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. And always and eternally, you'll never know how much your words and your ratings, your reviews, and your reaching out means to me. Here's to a magical and fabulous 2024 for us all. And here's episode 151 and my interview with Emerald Carter.
So again, I was being led by Spirit. I was being led by my heart, and ended up on a random block of my neighborhood that I had never been to before. And I sat down like on their port, on their stoop. And the sun was shining in this particular way, and it was kind of making me, it was making me a little emotional. And so the way it was shining was, I felt like it was leading me into the backyard. And then, yeah, I was just sitting in these people's backyard, had no idea who they were. And then this man came out and started talking to me, asked me if I needed water. I told him about all the things that I was experiencing that day, or I think this was the third day I had been in psychosis. So by that time I had a lot of things that I feel like were happening to me. I am a prayer. I am a poet. I am an artist. I'm a Black angel. I'm a spiritual genius. I'm a lover. I'm a friend. I'm a trained master of divinity. I'm a trained sociologist. I'm a bad bitch. I'm also very complex. I've been a liar. I've been a thief. I've been generous and outspoken. I've been naive about some things. I've been a Jill of all trades, a master of a few. Just a complete, full-fledged human being coming at you direct.
I love asking this question. It's such a delight to have another, you know, masters of divinity, human being to talk to. But I'm like, when you were a kid, did you have any concept that that would be part of your path?
Not at all. No, I've always been spiritual, and I knew in a lot of ways that my destiny was much bigger than I could understand at the time. But yeah, you know, I think I had models for how much attention I thought someone like me would kind of garner. But I didn't have a pathway towards, you know, divinity consultant, spiritual consultant, you know, artistic, creative. I didn't really have a path for all that. That was disappointing for a while when I was a kid. But then as I got older and started getting more into myself, I realized that I was going to have to chart my own path, and then also that it was going to be a lonely process.
So many of the people that I interview who are in the creative field or dabble in the creative field, it was almost a compulsion when they were a kid to like either paint or do writing or create comics. Was that the same for you when you were a kiddo?
No, I was an avid reader. That was my passion when I was younger. I read a lot, and I also would play teacher a lot. Yeah, I would play teacher a lot. So I would set up my dolls on my bed, and I would tape computer paper to my closet wall and like teach them what I had learned. I had an attendance book, and dolls would be absent. I'd have to go call their parents. Like, I was a full-fledged, I was in the game. I was serious about it too. So that's kind of how my imagination flourished. It was through sharing information. And then reading was, and specifically self-help, like I was really into Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul kind of stuff. That whole series, I was really into that. So yeah, no, I didn't, I can tell you my villain origin story, but in terms of like how my disappointment with organized religion, specifically the Christian church, kind of dissipated. But I didn't know that this was my path. But I just knew that it didn't look like everybody else's.
First, I have to say, I love that you had an attendance book. I think that's like the best thing I've ever heard. And that some of the dolls were absent and you kept track of that. I think that's amazing. I mean, when I was a kid, I set up a fake restaurant in the basement, and it was Italian food. And I made menus and I pretended to run an Italian restaurant. But it's kind of fascinating what kids do or how they are in the world and, you know, how it kind of shapes them, or it's kind of a little bit of a notion of what they're going to do later on in life. I mean, I don't own an Italian restaurant, but I did work in restaurants forever. I mean, I enjoyed it.
I met you cooking. So
yes, I know. Mm-hmm. I know. God, I love cooking so much. I do not want to run my own place, but I love cooking for other people. It's super thrilling for me. It's really, mm-hmm. really exciting. But I was going to thank you for answering what some of your favorite books were, because I was an avid reader, and I have to say that I'm a sci-fi fantasy person. Mm-hmm. And my mom really got me started with the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That was kind of the first thing that I jumped into. And I thought, wow. And then Madeline L'Engle, her, Wrinkle in Time, Ring of Endless Light, that, which she's some of her books are quite religious. But for you, it was the chicken soup series, it sounds like. The
self-help stuff, yeah. And I didn't know it back, you know, I didn't really call it that back then. I read a lot of magazines as well. Like, I was into magazines and stuff like that. So I liked reading people's letters to the editor, or, you know, even the Chicken Soup for the Soul. Those are young people writing in about, you know, their experiences and stuff like that. So I was more into, I liked fiction, and I think I got into that more when I was a preteen and a teenager. But from the beginning, it was definitely nonfiction, self-help. And I also like the American Girl series. I was a nonfiction reader.
Okay. And was reading and like kind of learning really fostered in your house?
So, yes. Growing up, I was praised for how intelligent and smart I am. But that was about it. So I think I learned early that if I kept my head in books and, you know, did my work kind of thing, that I would at least get some acknowledgement and praise. But I didn't grow up in a household like full of books. And my grandmother who raised me, I think she had a sixth grade education, but she played like the crosswords in the paper every day. And she had a couple of books in her room that I would like sneak and go read. So like How Stella Got Her Groove Back and Waiting to Exhale. Like, she had those books in her room and I would sneak and read them because they had sex scenes. So I wasn't supposed to, you know. But yeah, so it wasn't, you know, my parents are not academics or anything like that.
I love that you were sneaking How Stella Got Her Groove Back. I remember I just told my mom the other day, I said, oh my God, I remember finding The Joy of Sex in her closet, like buried under 10,000 pounds of clothes and stuff, like very clearly hidden. And I think it was hidden so well that I was maybe in high school when I found it, or junior high. Anyway, I was like, whoa, this is funny. I thought it was actually hilarious. And I thought, I guess I know why it's hidden. I mean, both those books are incredible. I don't know if The Joy of Sex is incredible, at least in the 70s and 80s. I don't know if it was incredible, but obviously she had good taste. Let's just say that. So thank goodness. Thank goodness.
Right. For all of us.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That's so important. Mm-hmm. So have you always lived in Massachusetts? Or I have to tell you, I've always dreamt of coming out to the East Coast and going to Massachusetts, just because it looks so beautiful. And because there are all these, I mean, this might not be true anymore, but all these like cute little villages scattered all over the place. Have you always lived there?
No, I haven't always lived in Massachusetts. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. That's where I grew up. And I went to boarding school out in Concord, Massachusetts. So I spent 4 years of my high school experience in Massachusetts, and then I stayed for college. So I went to Tufts University in Somerville, and then I moved back to New York after those seven, eight years.
First of all, I have never been to boarding school, public school, but I always have these beautiful, I love learning. I'm like endlessly curious. And if I could be in school for the rest of my life, I totally would. And I always think of boarding school as like the ultimate fantasy for me, because I would imagine that the educational system is super rigorous and you learn so much. I mean, I don't know if that was your experience. Maybe I'm totally off base about boarding school, but in my mind, like in my kid's mind about going to school and learning forever in boarding school, I always imagined that learning maybe would be more fun or more exciting. I could be totally wrong.
Okay. And then I never addressed that now I live in Massachusetts because I, 3 years ago, I got a job at my alma mater. And then, so I did that for a year, but it was a little, it was kind of cool. I did that for a year, but it wasn't for me. And so I switched boarding schools. So now I'm at a different one. Now I'm back in Massachusetts after being away for like 10, 11 years, but 7, 8 years. I think it depends. I think at the root of it, boarding schools are academically everything that's wrong with our society. in terms of like, if you're thinking about the wrongs of our society, boarding schools and then like IVs and those kind of like places are kind of what keep the wheels turning of capitalism, racism, phobias, all that stuff, right? While as a student, I loved boarding school because my home environment wasn't great. And I saw going to boarding school as an opportunity to be by myself and be on my own. I definitely learned a lot. It was very rigorous. I definitely wasn't like an A+, you know, student or anything like that. But I was a Black girl, chubby, not rich, in the middle of nowhere at a predominantly white school. And so, you know, when, you know, my friends were, or my classmates were buying Uggs, you know, or the Ralph Lauren polos, you know, I felt really out of that cultural lexicon. When parents came for parents' weekend, you know, my family only got up here once for one of those weekends because of the distance. And a lot of my classmates, they're from within an hour away somewhere else in New England. So, but because I am intelligent, I am very also very much a social butterfly. And so I got picked to do a lot of speaking things. I was very much I wasn't necessarily a token in terms of just going from my side, going along with the flow, but I was definitely one of the Black students that they picked when things of diversity would come up and to say, hey, we have a Black, you know? So yeah, there's a lot to learn. You know, going to boarding school definitely gave me a leg up. I don't even want to say a leg up, but it definitely helped the trajectory of my academic career in terms of, you know, going on to Tufts and then seminary. I'm not always sure it was worth it. And now that I work at boarding schools, I'm like more towards the it wasn't worth it, because technically, you know, I'm still barely out of working class in terms of income. Friends that I grew up with before going to boarding school, you know, they're just as successful financially as I am. You know, they're married, you know, things like that. So some of those signifiers of success, I'm not doing any better than anybody else having had gone to boarding school. And sometimes I think, especially when it comes to being a person of color on these campuses, you know, in a lot of ways we're plucked from our environments and our intelligence is siphoned into these suburban neighborhoods. And a lot of the work that Black people of color end up doing in these specific PWI environments is civilizing and educating rich people's kids. So, and I wasn't compensated for any of that work, right? Because in their eyes, in the eyes of the administrations, you know, it's a privilege for me to be there anyway. So I can talk about boarding school and the origins of boarding schools and all that stuff all day. But mostly it's a year-long summer camp and, you know, with academics.
Thank you for that. That's super helpful for me. I think, I don't know why I have this idea of boarding school and learning. Well, you know.
I know why.
You're like, I can tell you, year-long summer camps. I love that. I love that. Well, I know we touched on this just a tiny bit earlier, but my second question is always, I've asked you a lot already, but did you grow up in a religious household?
No, yes and no. My grandmother was raised Catholic. And so on special occasions, we would go to the Catholic church down the block from us. So for like Easter, things like that. But we were definitely cafeteria Christians. but, you know, we also like prayed before dinner and, you know, we're taught to say our prayers at night. My grandmother kept a Bible with birthdays and death dates and phone numbers. And I didn't get going with the church until my cousin, who lived with my grandmother, my brother and I on and off, until she started getting into her spiritual journey, and would take my brother and I, or sometimes just me, with her to church. So yeah, so, and I was around 5 or 7, so like 1993, 1995. And yeah, so that's, you know, in that church in Coney Island, that's where my villain origin story starts in terms of my spiritual trajectory. But yeah, definitely my household wasn't religious at all. Again, I wasn't beat over the head with the Bible. I was beat over the head with different things. So,
you know, you and I had a brief conversation when we met in person, and I think you went to Union Theological Seminary. Is that correct? Am I remembering?
I did. Yeah.
And I think I remember telling you when I met you in person that I was super jealous, because yeah, that was also a seminary that I looked at. But I thought to myself, you know, I'm in Portland, Oregon. It's all the way on the other side of the country, and I've always wanted to live in Santa Fe, and I live is in Denver. And so that's where I ended up going, and I'm so grateful. But Union Theological Seminary has an incredible, incredible reputation for just intelligent discourse, being kind of an exciting, you know, obviously you can tell that I like school, right? Because I'm going on and on about various educational programs that are amazing to me. But was it challenging to find a good place to go? Or, and if this is too private, please, you don't have to talk about it, but how did you decide to go to seminary?
Great question. And yeah, no, if there's anything that comes up that I'm not willing to answer, I'll definitely let you know, but this is going great so far. So the summer that Michael Jackson died, I had a lot going on, as well as like one of my heroes growing up passing away. And so I was in a really bad way for a while. And my cousin's godmother invited me to a church in Harlem that was just kind of getting its feet under itself in terms of membership. And things like that. So I wouldn't go on Sundays. I would just go to Bible study. And the pastor and I ended up having a really good back and forth. I would challenge him on a lot of things, and he would challenge me on a lot of things. And eventually, you know, I became a part of the community. People started calling me Grasshopper. It was a very pivotal, lovely moment in my life, because up until that point, I had very much like disconnected from the church. The main reason was I found that people were saying one thing and doing another. And then on top of that, it wasn't intellectually stimulating. And so when I found this church, it felt like they were doing both. At the end of one Bible study, I heard Spirit say, I want you to go to seminary. And I didn't know what seminary was, other than my pastor had gone to seminary. He went to what's the one in North Carolina? Duke. He went to Duke Divinity School, I think, something like that. And yeah, I heard Spirit clear as day. And I was like, oh, what are you talking about? But I went down there to where he was after Bible study, told him that that's what I wanted to do. And he gave me this big, like, paternal, like, grin, almost like, you know, I'm glad you finally came around kind of thing. And he said, I know the new president of Union Theological Seminary up the block. And he was like, write your recommendation and I'll sign it. And yeah, so I didn't apply to a whole bunch of I almost feel bad sometimes telling this story, because I know people like, they kind of like go their whole lives like knowing they want to go to seminary. And like, I just was like, what is seminary? I'm going next year, you know? But at the same time, I was called. There's no other way to describe it. I was called, and I answered the call, and I went, and it was some of the best years of my life.
I mean, would you feel comfortable sharing or talking about your writing at all?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. well, I know that, and I don't want to just confine you by saying that you're a writer, because you might do other things as well, but what does your creative life look like?
Great question. broadly, my creative practice is solely about communication, whether that's me communicating through words or through images or through 30 minutes of spiritual uplift with one of my friends or clients. Yeah, it's all about communication. The nitty gritty of it is that I had to learn to heed the spark. So if a poem comes on my heart, I have a designated place where that goes. It's usually in a notes app first, and then it'll make its way to handwritten, and then maybe I'll share it, you know, put it in a more professional place other than my notes app. But yeah, it's I'm not at that place yet of, you know, I wake up at 6 and, you know, I'm writing for an hour and then that's when how I get my day started. I'm definitely not there, and I'm not even sure if that's where I need to be. But yeah, my favorite pieces are the ones that I was obedient with getting them out right away and having something on my spirit and then making sure I didn't lose it.
I think that's such a gorgeous way to phrase it. You know, well, I love the word obedient, because honestly, you gave an example before about spirit coming to you and saying, oh, you're going to go to seminary, and you were obedient and you went, and your life has presumably, because I don't want to make assumptions, open up in all sorts of beautiful ways. But you can also be obedient with, you know, the muse, or when spirit gives you a poem or a song, no matter what kind of creative endeavor you slog through when you're working with it or on it. It really is like this gift from the gods. And I love that you say that, use the word obedient, but also that you have this process of, you know, first putting it in notes and then you write it down and, you know, it goes from there, because there is a process, right? Mm-hmm. And I love the image of it on your heart, you know, mm-hmm. the poem coming, being on your heart. And I just love the idea that creative, whether you're a painter or a writer, or you sing, like it's channeled through the heart, or it's on the heart before it comes into the world. That's just so exquisite. Thank you.
I think I knew early on that singing was my spiritual practice. Like, it was when I didn't have a lot of spiritual practices besides prayer, singing was the one that was most consistent. And yeah, it's the same process. It's the, oh, it's like 9 p.m. Like, I can use a song right now, you know, and then I'll have an hour of just karaoke in the bed, or, you know, putting the music on when I'm in the shower. But what I realized is that it helps me release a lot. For example, my go-to karaoke song is the Thong Song. And it's definitely less about, I'm a Cisco stan. I love Cisco. But it's less about the content of the song and more about the fact that he's like really screaming and yelling on that song. It's very rock and roll in a lot of ways. And that resonates with me, because when I hit those belts, you know, when I'm just like, doesn't matter what this sounds like, I need to get this out. That's what I use it for.
I really love that image of you in karaoke singing the Thong Song, but because it's helping you channel energy, right? It's, you're getting, you know, whatever that energy is, whether it's icky or it's heavy or what have you, out of your body. I was just, you know, I talk to a lot of people who do different kind of, they have different healing modalities on the show, but the general gist of a lot of them is that, you know, people's stories, the things people tell themselves, that little voice inside your head, you know, that voice can be really critical, and, you know, we can be mean to ourselves, but those things get stuck inside our bodies and we need some way to channel them, to purge mm-hmm. ourselves, to like mm-hmm. cleanse ourselves. And I actually think the Thong Song during karaoke is probably the best modality I've heard for doing mm-hmm. it. So mm-hmm. thank you.
You're welcome. I remember singing it one night in this older person person came up to me and was like, oh, you really changed my life. Like, I now know I want to be a different person tomorrow. And I was like, well, I sang the thong song. Like, who were you trying to be tonight? Like, what exactly moved you there? But again, I think it's in the performance. I think what a lot of people have appreciated me for is they think I don't give a fuck. But it's less about not caring, and it's more about caring, but doing it anyway, right? Like, it's really hard for me to embarrass myself. You know what I mean? And I think the courage, the bravery, that kind of, you know, vibe is what people are responding to in a lot of ways. Yeah, the thong song is one of those songs. It was like a cultural moment, but it had all of the it had a good recipe for everything that I love about R&B and hip hop. So yeah. I would love to share some things. Yeah, I think what I mentioned a couple of times is my villain origin story. I've only recently just started calling it that. But when I was going to Sunday school while my cousin went to church, one day we were learning about Jesus's miracles. And I asked the teacher when we were going to start water walking classes. And she was like, that's blasphemous. Like, I got totally like disciplined and more or less asked like not to come back. And it really hurt my feelings, because I think undergirding, you know, at 5 or 6, like what I understood about Jesus was that, you know, he was basically like, you know, anything I can do, you can do better, right? And so I was like, yeah, like, when do we learn the miracle stuff, right? I wanted Sunday school to be practical in that way, but it wasn't about that, right? And now looking back, it was more about indoctrination, right? But yeah, that kind of dismissal definitely colored my relationship from the church. But then my brother and I had a babysitter who lived on the 21st floor of our building. And we would go to her in the morning sometimes, but we would always go to her after school. And she had a husband who had Alzheimer's at the time, who ended up passing away maybe when I was about 7 or 8. So maybe a few years into us being her being our babysitter. And then when I was around 10, she stopped being our babysitter because I was old enough and my brother was old enough. He was 13, that we could walk home alone and we could stay at home by ourselves after school. And so I would just go and check on her every once in a while, because again, older woman, now she was by herself without her husband. And I loved her. I loved Mrs. Smith. I thought she, everything that my grandmother wasn't, she was. And of course that has a lot to do with the amount of time we spent with her. And you don't really know that back then, but she was very much a refuge for me. So I went upstairs to check on her one day after school. And when I get off the elevator, it sounds like a party's coming from her apartment. And I didn't know Mrs. Smith to have parties. Like, the most noise that she would have in the apartment, she was in like 1010 Winds, like the news or radio station. So it was very jarring to hear like swing music, people talking, chattering, coming from her apartment. So I knocked on a door. And when she answered, it went completely silent. And I said, Miss Smith, are you having a party? And she said, no. And I was like, well, was the radio on? And she said, no. And I was just perplexed, because she just said, she had just gotten in from the store. And I was confused. I didn't know what was going on. But, you know, I paid my visit. Went back home. And then within the next, I want to say week or so, her daughter called my grandmother to say that she had passed away. And then she passed away, she said that Mrs. Smith believed that I had heard her husband and her son coming back to get her. So yeah. So it changed my life. Yeah. because Miss Smith was she was the first person to call me special. and my family treated me as such, but she was the first person to articulate it when I was a child. And so having that relationship with her, and then with her death, even when she passed, I remember my brother started crying, like when my grandmother told us. And then because he cried, I cried, right? So like even in a way, I wasn't like grieving her, or, you know, in the way that my brother was, because I felt like I still had this connection to her. And sometimes like the lights would flicker or the television would turn off, that kind of stuff. And then I would feel like she was still with me. And then even today, like I said, I think, you know, the timing of this conversation is important, because it's been a few years since I started like thanking my ancestors along with God. When I wake up in the morning and I actually name the people that I know who have passed on, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith, sometimes I forget to name them. And then I always get kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot to name y'all. But today I was sitting, I promise you, I was sitting on the couch and thinking about the conversation that I had where I had set those boundaries that we were talking about earlier, and remember telling him that, you know, I need to consult my ancestors. And so when I was sitting on the couch today, I was like thinking of my ancestors specifically. I think I was thinking about Mrs. Smith, and I promise you, I could feel her sitting next to me. And that was my first feeling, emotional understanding of what it meant that my ancestors walk with me, right? Like they are literally on my sides. It was almost like a muscle I had built, whereas like I had been saying thank you to my ancestors for a while. It was today that I was just like, oh, I can feel you all sitting beside me.
Feel like, and I'm sure you'll agree with me, when you're a kid, to be witnessed by someone else or seen deeply by someone else and then kind of loved on and appreciated and kind of brought into the fold is so powerful and such a gift. And
yeah,
I was listening to your story, and I've had multiple people on the podcast who tell stories about watching a loved one, you know, for the last few weeks before they pass away. And invariably the loved one starts having conversations with people that are not there, and they'll have full on conversations, mm-hmm. and they'll say, oh, I'm just talking to Aunt Ruth. And the mm-hmm. person knows Aunt Ruth has already died. So there are all these kind of really interesting liminal experiences that happen to people who are about to cross over, mm-hmm. and not be on this earth anymore. And so mm-hmm. I think it's really fascinating that you heard a super fun party with amazing music. I think that yep. is actually, I mean, the best. And then the second the door opens, silence.
Just, it was almost like a gust of wind kind of came out of the apartment.
I have mm-hmm. to say that is, I mean, maybe one of the more powerful and beautiful stories I've heard, because it's almost as if, you know, Mrs. Smith was being reminded of the party that was waiting for her.
Yep,
the music,
yeah.
The people.
The party was for her. The party was her homegoing party. And from what I knew about her and her husband and how long they had been together and how much that I that they loved each other and their family, it made sense. It made sense that, you know, they were celebrating having her back, because she was the best. I was gonna say they better play some late 90s, early 2000s music when they come back to get me, when he's shaking my ass. Yeah, shaking my ass to the other side. In 2016, I had my first psychotic episode. It was like some of the best days of my life. In terms of long story short, too long didn't read. I believe I was invited to join a secret society when I was in that state. I was in a state of moving from my heart and not from my mind. It was almost like my brain completely shut off, and I was just going where my heart led me, and it led me to someone giving me a book called The Golden Dawn. And when I went to sit down and read it in a park, didn't really, you know, I didn't have a jacket, any images on the cover or on the spine, but first page said The Golden Dawn, and then you flip to where the writing starts, and it said, the contents of this book is a secret. Only special people get to have access to it. And, you know, it's meant to remain a secret. In my, you know, euphoric mind, I was very much like, I don't believe in secrets, right? I don't believe in secrets. And I ended up just leaving the book where I was. I left, ended up leaving all of my stuff and like continuing on my journey. I left my keys, my phone, the book. I think I brought a yoga mat outside with me, left that all under a tree in Hollis, Queens, on a baseball field. And yeah, just went along about my journey, and fortunately slash unfortunately wound up in the psychiatric ward maybe an hour or so later. I'm of two minds about it in terms of what it meant, quote unquote. I think that because later on I found out that the Golden Dawn is an actual secret society that like is ancient, and has its roots in like British occultism and American occultism. And I had no idea about that organization prior to. So in a way, that lets me know that I wasn't making the whole thing up. But if I was initiated into anything, it feels like for me, the test was to be clear that I don't believe in spiritual secrets, and that whatever understandings about the universe that I come to know is not going to be because I dedicated my life to an organization. It's going to be because I lived it, and I'm going to have free rein to share that information with others. After the psych ward, I went on a long journey of doing research about the Golden Dawn, because I did feel bad that I didn't keep the book. A part of me was a little disappointed in myself. And I found a Freemason library in the middle of New York City, and went there and asked them about, asked them if they had any Golden Dawn books. And the guy looked at me weird, but he came and brought out like 7 books, but none of them started the way the book that I had read started. But it was all occult, right? It was damn near like reading Greek. I decided then that I was like, okay, I'm not going to pursue this further because I'm not supposed to.
Well, I have not interviewed anyone who's been joined, who's been asked to join the Illuminati. So you're first. I can imagine that, I mean, of course, I don't know. I think most people have heard of the Illuminati. They're worldwide. And I kind of am so intrigued by the fact that you had this book that you left behind with everything else in this park, and it had this singular beginning. And you haven't been able to find it since. That's Mm-mm. actually kind of fascinating.
Wild, right? It was a thick ass book too. It was a big book. It wasn't necessarily heavy, but it was thick. And yeah, there were more words on that page. It was just how the chapter or the section started, I guess. But after I read it, I was like, nah, not for me. And I just went on about my life, which now in hindsight, I'm proud of. And being able to leave all my stuff behind was also a lesson as well in a lot of ways for me, because I realized I didn't need a lot. And then I had also like left my keys. And so when I got out of the hospital, I didn't have keys, but I ended up not having keys for like 5 years to like my building, just because they were trying to charge me like mad money to replace it. And my neighbors were like, nah, like whenever you're, you know, when you're coming home, just ring the bell. And so eventually I got like the key to like the front couple of doors of my building, but I never locked my door. My neighbors always took care of me in that way.
Good. That's actually really beautiful that mm-hmm. you didn't lock your door. And I love that you lived there for so long without keys.
I mean, I didn't need them.
That's amazing.
Didn't need them.
Did you ever go back to your friend who gave you the book and say, hey, was
okay,
that
okay? So It wasn't a friend. It was, so again, I was being led by spirit. I was being led by my, my heart and ended up on a random block of my neighborhood that I had never been to before. And I sat down like on their porch, on their stoop. And the sun was shining in this particular way. And it was kind of making me, it was making me a little emotional. And so the way it was shining was, I felt like it was leading me into the backyard. And then, yeah, I was just sitting in these people's backyard, had no idea who they were. And then this man came out and started talking to me, asked me if I needed water. I told him about all the things that I was experiencing that day, or I think this was the third day I had been in psychosis. So by that time I had a lot of things that I feel like were happening to me. And he listened. He was curious. Again, he brought me a bottle of water and he said, I think I have something for you. And so I was like, okay. So I went into this random man's house and he went downstairs into his basement, came back up with a book. And I was like, oh, thanks. Right. Like, again, like not, not like really thinking anything. Thanks so much for the book. Like, love books. Right. So, as soon as he gave me the book, the two women that lived in that house had come home, and the older woman was carrying balloons. The other one with her was her daughter. And I said hello and I was like, oh, is it your birthday? And the mom was like, yeah, it's my birthday. And I immediately dropped to the floor because part of what I had been experiencing in my psychosis, my psychotic state started like August 1st. And by that time it was August 4th, which is also Barack Obama's birthday. And so she shared a birthday with Barack Obama. Part of like what I was feeling and hearing in that time was that I was going to be president and, you know, I was going to change the world kind of thing. So when I dropped to the floor, the daughter was like, all right, this is a little dramatic. You're going to have to go. And I was like, oh, thank you so much for letting me into your home. And I'm sorry I caused a scene. Let me get out of here with my book. And so I think I walked past the house maybe a few years later, but I never knocked again. And he had already said that he was moving soon to like Connecticut or like New Rochelle or something like that. So I doubted that had I gone back, I would have found him again. So again, random man. random people.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually really fascinating. That encounter is very fascinating. Thank you for sharing that story with me. I feel like I could think about this story for like a few weeks and kind of ruminate on it. And I don't know, there's a lot there to think about. So thank you for sharing that with me.
Well, I'll share a poem that I wrote while I was reading a book of Rumi's poetry, a translation called Gold. So it's called Shams and Rumi. I know heartbreak because I have known ecstasy. I know poetry because I have known sermons. I know the universe because I have known myself. I know friendship because I have known foil. I know God because I have known loneliness. I know future because I have known the past. I know grace because I have known failure. I know faith because I have known patience. I know strength because I have known fragility. I know jealousy because I have known religion. I know rest because I have known race. I know climax because I have known resolution. I know light because I have known nothing. And I know you because you have known me.
That is so beautiful. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I'm just completely, the line that captured me was, I know God because I've known loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually really, again, I mean, I'm thinking about it and I'm like, okay, I need to think about this for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. Profound.
Thank you. I'm an English teacher by trade. and I gave my students a prompt of writing about trying to marry like one of the happiest or most joyful moments of their life with one of the saddest or ones that it's hard for them to talk about, like trying to have that conversation with those two things in a poem. And so when I ask my students to do any type of writing exercise, I try to give them an example of like what I would write. So just to show them that there is a process, it's not going to be perfect in the beginning. And just share that process with them. So that's what this is the poem that came out of it.
You know, the longer I talk to you, I just think to myself, what do you not do?
Let me see.
I also love, you know what I love? You're like an English teacher now, but you know, mm-hmm. when you were a kid, you were teaching your dolls. You were, fascinating. There is you probably know this already, a Jungian analyst who wrote a book about how what you did as a child or how you played mm-hmm. as a child.
Yep.
Is a precursor of what you're going to do or what's going to make you happy as an adult. And would you
tell my students that all the time? Yep.
Okay. So do you agree then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. However people found joy as children is how they're going to find it as an adult. And a lot of the work we have to do in adulthood is marrying the world's expectations with the things that bring us joy, or letting go of the world's expectations in pursuit of those things that bring us joy. And for a lot of people, when I listen to podcasts and things like that, for a lot of people, it's going back to whatever was exciting to them when they were children.
Enjoyed the poem that Emerald shared. I just love the way that Emerald's mind works, and I also appreciate that she can hold a lot of different things in her mind, being a teacher, mentoring young folks, being an artist, living in the mystery, and in general, just being a super positive and supportive human being. I need to thank Emerald for being so vulnerable and for sharing all of their stories on the podcast. Of course, as you well know, I couldn't do this podcast without the music that I use, so complete attribution for the podcast will be in the episode's show notes. This week, I need to thank Sasha End, Agnes Velmagia, Frank Schroeder, Taiga Sound Productions, and Sasha End. Did I say his name already? At any rate, of course, complete attribution will be in the episode's show notes. If you want to find other groovy things or discover other guests that I've had on the pod or just find out a little bit about me, I did a website redesign. Check out the website, see what you think. My third book is coming out so very soon, the third in the Peter Rabbit series. I have a lot of exciting things going on, including starting a super fun YouTube channel. I need to say, of course, what I say every time I wrap up a podcast. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Emerald. When you are shown a glimpse of the mystery, a glimpse of the magic in this world, no matter if it's in the apartment of a dear neighbor or in the backyard of a total stranger, go with the flow. You never know where that magic or that mystery is going to lead you, or the doors that it might open for you. Just know that you're tended to, that you're witnessed, and that good things are out there, that good things await all of us. So be like Emerald and live in this world with the ease of knowing that it's a truly magical and wondrous place. I'll see you next week for episode 152, and until then, have a beautiful, beautiful week.